The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to the second anniversary episode of Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're focusing on the fluid that nourishes our bodies and kind of creeps us out when it doesn't stay where it belongs. It's an hour on blood with Holly Tucker, author of the new book, Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. But first, Skepticality co-host Robin Swoopy McCarthy joins us to discuss what it's like to train as a phlebotomist. Thanks for listening. I'm here today with Robin Swoopy McCarthy, director of the DragonCon podcasting track and the co-director of SkepTrack, and host of the original fantastic skeptical podcast, Skepticality. Welcome back to the show, Swoopy.
Hey, Desiree. Thanks so much for having me back. It's great to talk to you.
So you are here to talk about something else that you do, which is not any of those things. It's phlebotomy. So what is that?
Phlebotomy is a word that literally means to incise a vein. And of course, that's not something we do anymore. We do it with very, very sharp needles. So I'm one of those people. I've been certified and trained to take blood from people for diagnostic purposes or to monitor levels of blood components and things like that.
So how does one practice those skills? Because I imagine that people aren't exactly lining up to have their veins stabbed by a newbie.
Well, when you're training to become a phlebotomist, that's one of those things that everybody has to do. And so in order to get the number of different sticks in order to complete your training, you have to do them on other members of your class. And therefore, if you don't volunteer to be stuck, no one's going to want to let you stick them. And so it's kind of a give and take. And so I had a fairly large class, so I got quite a lot of practice before I was a certified phlebotomist on actual people. They also do make phlebotomy arms, though, for very beginning students that are artificial with artificial blood and all of that good stuff. So we don't start jabbing people right away.
Good to know. So did you have any problems with the sight of blood at all, or was that not an issue for you?
Nope, it's absolutely not an issue for me. And that's obviously a good thing to take into consideration if you're thinking about becoming a phlebotomist. There were people that I took classes with who were not thrilled about being stuck with needles and mildly squeamish. Some of them got over it and some of them didn't, but it's never been a problem for me.
That would be an interesting choice for someone who is squeamish at the sight of blood.
It would.
So what made you want to learn how to do this then?
I just have found it really, really interesting. I was looking at maybe changing my career a little bit. And so I was reviewing different courses of science certifications that I could reasonably take on. And phlebotomy just jumped right out at me. It sounded really interesting. My mother's a registered nurse, and she works a lot with kidney dialysis patients, and there's a lot of phlebotomy involved in that. So it sounded like a lot of fun, and I was really engaged with it right from the start.
So why is phlebotomy a specialized area? Because this is something that nurses are trained to do as well, aren't they?
They are, but it's actually much more efficient to have people who are specifically trained in doing phlebotomy because nurses and doctors have a lot more important things to do. And also, they can be multitasking while someone is drawing blood for them. Regular labs are part of just about everybody's regular examinations or checkups. And so phlebotomists get it done in a very efficient manner because we practice it a lot. And so it's just part of the medical team, and it's a very important one.
So what are some of the specific things that you learn then?
The main skill that's important to master right out of the gate is basically drawing blood from someone's arm, or what is called venipuncture. And blood is most commonly drawn from the median cubital vein, and that's within the cubital fossa, and that's the inside of your elbow. It's anterior to your elbow on the fleshy soft side on the front. And that's because that's one of the least painful areas to get it from. However, I think most people have experienced not being able to have their blood drawn on the first try. And so there are lots of other places we can get it from too. So that's one of the first things that you learn. We also do other things, urinalysis testing, glucose testing, lots of other different kinds of lab tests.
So going back there, why is it often difficult to find a vein?
Well, because everybody's anatomy is different. You more or less can't say that you know for sure where a vein is if you can't see it or feel it. And so it's very important. It's one of the pre-analytical considerations to drawing somebody's blood is site selection. And it really is the most important part because you don't want to cause people any pain and you don't want to have to stick them more than once if you don't have to. And getting a patent, bouncy, lovely vein full of blood that will fill up your tubes in an efficient and fast manner is important not only for the patient, but in getting reliable test results back. So it is just a skill, and everybody's different. Some people have very small veins, and some people don't. Some people have veins you can totally see or feel, and other people don't.
Is there anything that we can do to help you guys out to make our veins more pronounced, perhaps?
Hydrate. Definitely. If you can increase your fluids and things like that, that certainly helps. That's really the biggest thing you can do. If you've had your blood drawn before, oftentimes the first thing someone will ask you is, have you had your blood drawn? And if you have, where is it that usually they will take the blood from? So it narrows down the choices of where successfully blood has been obtained from you before. So that's a help. But definitely, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. And especially if you're going to donate blood, make sure you eat a good meal first.
Because Swoopy wants fat veins.
I do. I absolutely do. It's funny. Everybody always laughs that the moment you sit someone down in the chair and you help them roll up their sleeve, if you can see their veins, we get all excited and say, ooh, those are great. So, and it's not like the person really had anything to do with it, but you're giving them a compliment nonetheless.
Absolutely. We take compliments where we can get them. So when I was younger, needles used to make me faint. So any words of wisdom for those of us who maybe respond poorly to needles?
It is just a physiological reaction. Some people just automatically do, either at the sight of blood or at the thought of pain. Sometimes there's absolutely nothing you can do about fainting, but definitely make sure that the person who's going to take your blood is aware of it, because there are things that we can watch for, and we will absolutely be very careful and make sure that if you look like you are going to pass out, that the safest procedures are taken to make sure that you don't come to any harm when you're about to pass out. Definitely need to be sitting in a secure area and taking lots of nice deep breaths and maybe have somebody else watching out for you while you're having your blood drawn.
I could see you being very good at this.
I'd like to think that I am. I'm pretty confident in my skills. I'm not intimidated. And it is kind of fun if you think about it, that every different opportunity is a challenge because, again, everybody's anatomy is different. And so every time I'm drawing blood from someone is a learning experience. And that's fun and fascinating.
Swoopy, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Desiree. So, you know, do you need any blood drawn today?
Not today, thanks.
Okay.
You're very nice and all, but I think I'll, pass.
If you're sure.
You can find Swoopy and her show at skepticality.com. There's also a link to it on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. Sticking with the theme, stay tuned for our feature interview with Holly Tucker, author of the new book, Bloodwork, about blood transfusions in the 17th century. We'll be right back with that after this quick chat that I had with William Rutherford about Urey's Night. I'm here with William Rutherford, science interpreter at the TELUS World of Science. William is organizing the Edmonton edition of Urey's Night. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Will.
Hello, thank you.
So who is Urey and why does he get a knight?
It was on April 12, 1961 that Yuri Gagarin forever changed the world as we know it. That day, the Cold War era space race literally took flight as Gagarin became the first man to fly in space piloting the Vostok 1 on a single orbit around Earth.
And that is totally off the yurisknight.net site, isn't it?
Yeah, you know.
that's brilliant. So I was actually meandering about yurisknight.net, and there are events happening all over the world in celebration. So do you have any idea what other cities are doing?
Well, in the past, there's been parties as large as 12,000 at the NASA Ames Research Center in Northern California. And they've been as small as backyard barbecues of a few dozen members. So they vary in size and pretty much anyone that's interested in space exploration get together, and they can have a space trivia night or anything along those lines and just have a good time.
So this is an excuse for a nerd party.
Basically, yeah.
Brilliant. I support that. So what is the Edmonton TELUS World of Science up to then on April 12th?
Well, we got a whole lineup of events. We have a lot of space-themed stuff, like our space gallery, which will be open to the public. And as well, we'll have some live entertainment, such as DJ Hondo, Tilo Paez, and his sextet, and as well as a band that I'm in, Doomtech.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
A band called Doomtech playing at TELUS World of Science.
Yes, it's Middle Eastern drumming and a lot of Darbuka-like instruments.
So wait a second, before we get into the more sciencey stuff, so now you've put a Latin spin on a space event. So why? I'm intrigued.
It's a personal preference of mine, and I thought there was a lot of twists I could have, like Launchpad as being a name for it, or Salsa in Space.
Really, this event is for nerds by nerds.
For nerds by nerds.
Well done, sir. So you're also having a cosmonaut training on a multi-axis trainer. What is that?
A multi-axis trainer, it is a device that will be able to spin you around in two different directions. And as a result of that, you should not feel dizzy because of those counteracting forces not causing the fluid in your semicircular canal from being spun around. Not like when you roll down a hill and you get up and you feel really dizzy because that fluid keeps on moving. This will move you in two different directions. And you shouldn't get dizzy, but it's also a neat experience as well.
And it says here, explosive science demonstrations.
We always try to leave a night off with a bang. So we have tons of science demonstrations that we'll put on. Some explosive, some with a little item that you could taste at the end.
So your choices are between exploding things and something good to eat.
Exactly.
That's actually a hard choice now that I think about it.
We actually make ice cream out of liquid nitrogen, so.
Oh, okay. Now I've been there and I love that. Perfect.
Okay.
So how about you also have an IMAX film?
We do have an IMAX film. It's called Space Station, so you'll be able to see some footage taken right on board the International Space Station, and it's narrated by Tom Cruise.
And, of course, there is the obligatory planetarium show.
Mm-hmm. So we have a special show, which is called Dawn of the Space Age, and it covers all events of the space race, right from Sputnik right up to current-day events, and looking towards the future of a launch to Mars.
So is this a fun-for-the-whole-family event, or is it adults-only?
This is actually an adult-only event, and one of the very few that TELUS World of Science has actually put on, so we're looking forward to it and hoping that it's a success.
Now, was there actually sort of a request to have more adult-only events at Science World?
Well, it's something that we've been looking for. There's a lot of other science centers that have done adult events around times such as Valentine's Day, and we're looking to have our own, and what better night than Yuri's night?
There was a Valentine's Day adults-only science event.
Not in Edmonton.
Oh.
I mean, I could mention one that we know that happened at the Saskatchewan Science Center that was called Ionic Bonding.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Unfortunately, okay. We didn't get on to that one.
That, if I could put in my request now, if I could make that official. So now this is actually the first time that TELUS World of Science has held a Yuri's Night.
It is.
And that's because this was your idea?
Well, I don't want to take all the credit. There's been a couple of people helping me along the way, but it was 14 months ago that I made the initial proposal, but with only 2 months before the event, it wasn't enough time. So this year we've been a little bit more prepared and it's looking a go.
And you're also providing shuttle service.
Yep. We'll have an ETS charter bus taking anyone that is staying a little bit later than ETS will allow back to the university from the Science Center.
That is both kind and liability conscious.
Oh, of course.
So where can people go to find out information and to get tickets?
You can go directly to the Science Center. Our box office phone number is 780-451-3344. Or you can visit us, and our address is 11211 142nd Street here in Edmonton. Or you could go to Galante Galleries on the north end of Hub Mall, which will also be selling tickets to the event.
Perfect. Thanks very much for being here, Will.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So if you're in Edmonton, I will see you there. And if you're not, do check out yurisnight.net for information on events in your area. There are also links to both websites on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm very excited to have Holly Tucker as our guest today. She teaches courses on the history of early medicine, medicine and literature, as well as early French literature and culture at Vanderbilt University. Her writings appeared in publications like The New Scientist, The Wall Street Journal, and The Christian Science Monitor. And she's here to talk about her new book, Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Holly.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
So maybe to help us out, can you place transfusion in the 1600s into context? What qualified as medicine at that time?
Well, the transfusions in the 17th century and the 1600s were perfectly unthinkable until the late part of the century in the 1660s, because so much of medical practice was built on a system of humors, which meant that the body's health and ill health was dependent on how the various fluids, humors, there were four of them, phlegm, blood, black bile, and what they called yellow bile, how those four humors, those four fluids interacted with one another. So if your fluids, your humors were in balance, then you were in good health. And if your humors weren't in balance, then you were in ill health. And so bloodletting and leeches were the way that people understood early health, right? Because your humors, if you were not healthy, that meant that your humors were out of balance. So the fastest way to regain health, it was believed, was to do bloodletting. And, you know, if you weren't using lancets, to use leeches. So when they first started to imagine blood transfusion in the 17th century, it was entirely counterintuitive because they had spent millennia focusing on taking blood out, certainly not putting it in.
This was also tied to astrology in a number of ways.
Absolutely. In fact, any bloodletter, they called them barber surgeons because the same person who would be responsible for giving you a shave would also be the person who had the tools that were required for bloodletting, right? You needed to be able to have a good razor. You needed to have some semblance of a clean towel or rag. You needed to be able to work with blood because barbers would unintentionally nick somebody during a shave. And so eventually barbers became associated not just with shaves, also with any number of medical procedures. How astrology worked in bloodletting is that any barber surgeon worth his pay would have something that was, they called it a girdle book. It was a very large folio, a very large piece of very thick paper, or either that, some sort of animal skin, in which there'd be a series of, I guess for lack of a better description, Cliff's notes, right? In which there'd be indications about where to bleed for given ailments. So, for example, women who had some sort of menstrual troubles, or it was considered that they were not well because they'd either not menstruated or they're menstruating too much, is that it was indicated that the woman would be bled from the ankle, for example. So there would be, in the girdle books, is you'd have these indications. And then there typically were star charts in which you'd have a picture of usually a man drawn and different constellations all around that person's body. And those were indications about where not to bleed, depending on where the stars happen to be. And so there are different places in the body. And the one place, I'm a Scorpio, and I'm so glad I didn't live in the early modern period, or at least I'm so glad that I didn't need a bleeding when the stars were not in Scorpio, because Scorpio was associated at the time with virility and sensuality, et cetera, et cetera. And so right where the man's little private parts are is you'll find a Scorpio, and that's an indication, do not bleed from the penis. when the stars were in Scorpio.
They needed a map to tell them that.
Needed a map to tell that. What surprised me when I first came across this is that they were actually bleeding from a variety of places, because we have a tendency, and I think it comes from our understanding of phlebotomy, right? When I go to the doctor and have my blood drawn, it's usually from, you know, the crook of my arm. So I just always assumed that bloodletting took place, you know, on the arms. But these bloodletting charts tell us is that there are all different places from which they were drawing blood.
Now, this is sort of taking place before the discovery of circulation, when blood was seen as a fuel for the body?
Yes, it was believed, you know, again, based on what's called the humoral theory. And this is a theory that dates all the way back to Hippocrates. It was considered that blood was produced through the digestive system. So you eat something, it's concocted, was the word, in the stomach, and then it moves into the liver where it's distilled into blood. And from there, it was believed that this distilled blood would move to the heart, not to circulate, but rather to be burned off. In fact, the heart was seen as something of a fireplace to the body. So the blood would be burned off. And this was before they also recognized the role of the dynamics of the pulmonary system and the circulatory system, right? So it was assumed that the act of breathing was a way to stoke the heart's fires. So I breathe in and I help burn the kindling in the fireplace. And I breathe out, and that allows me to get rid of some of the smoke coming from my fireplace.
You know, this is really interesting because it sounds absurd, but when you think about it from the perspective of people who don't have the knowledge that we have now, that actually makes sense.
You know, and I teach the history of medicine at Vanderbilt. What I tell my students is that, you know, at that particular time, the worldview was such that this made a lot of sense. How we understand our world really depends on the viewpoints, right? The worldview through which we're seeing that world. And through that viewpoint, through those worldviews, is we're able to formulate a certain set of questions. And because we can only formulate a certain set of questions, we necessarily can only arrive at a certain set of answers.
Right.
And as we move through the courses that I teach, the students start to be able to understand not that they were lacking in some way, but rather all of this made sense from what the dominant worldview at the time.
So let's look at that worldview that you're talking about. Where was it looking when people decided that they were quite often going to be against blood transfusions? What did people think about the idea?
Well, to back that question up, you have to talk a little bit about the discovery of blood circulation, because blood circulation is what provided the impetus for natural philosophers, as scientists were called at the time, to even imagine being able to move foreign blood into another person. And so William Harvey in 1628 discovered blood circulation. He was English, and he did a very simple line of reasoning that is actually exquisite in its simplicity. So William Harvey was part of a growing movement from the Renaissance on that started to distrust longstanding views toward the body, toward basically anything through the religion, philosophy, you name it, politics, economics. So there's a questioning in the Renaissance that's going on. And so William Harvey is part of this long trajectory of folks who are saying, well, wait a second, wait. Yeah, that all makes sense, this humoral way of understanding the body, understanding blood production. But there's one thing that doesn't make sense, the presence of valves in the veins. It was thought that the valves, they were like locks in a river, is that there were ways to keep all of that blood from pooling in the feet before it could get to the heart and be burned off. So Harvey started to wonder, well, do we really understand what the heart's doing? So he did a whole bunch of dissections, and he ended up dissecting a human heart and measuring the amount of blood in one of the chambers. And he measured something like 2 ounces of blood. And then he counted the number of heartbeats on an average person over a half hour. And he did basic math, right? He multiplied 2 ounces by the number of beats in a half hour. And he ended up coming up with a number that was extraordinary, something like 41 pounds of blood would have to be produced in any given, half hour. And he realized just how crazy that was. And from there, he started to do a whole long line of questioning. If it is not at all possible that the human body could make that much blood, what has to be happening?
Now, that doesn't explain why the public thought that this was such a vaguely heretical idea.
Well, because William Harvey's discovery on blood circulation was unsettling, right? For over 1,500 years, there's one viewpoint about how the body is to be understood. And William Harvey says, no, everything you know is wrong. And a lot of people have a lot of stake in the power of historical knowledge. So for William Harvey to come in and to say something as extraordinary as, nope, the heart does not burn off blood. The first response was, huh? And the second response is, no way. Now, we know the truth. So Harvey's theories were differently accepted in different places in Europe. In Protestant England, this is really interesting. We need to test it. In a place like Catholic France, which had spent much of its efforts during the religious wars of the 16th century, pushing back Protestant resistance and actually winning, and had spent so many resources trying to preserve tradition, there is no way that they wanted to enter into the idea that blood circulated because they associated it with something heretical.
I'm thinking really of the idea of using animal blood. There's something, now I understand scientists being sort of against the maintaining of a new theory when, you know, and everybody has stock in that, but how did the public react?
They were using animal blood for the first human transfusions, which took place. So William Harvey was 1628, and the first human transfusions took place in the 1660s, 1667. So what happened in the meantime, experiments that were done in the 1650s, particularly in England, on animals, testing Harvey's discovery of blood circulation. And they needed some way to be able to test Harvey's theories, and they can't do that on dead people because blood doesn't circulate right in death. So they reached to animals and they started doing infusion experiments as a way first to test on animals. So somebody like Christopher Wren in the 1650s was doing all numbers of infusion experiments with water, milk, beer, wine, opium on dogs to be able to see just how the blood circulated. And there was a leap that eventually happened in between the 1650s and 1660s when they started doing transfusion experiments that started first animal to animal and then animal to human. There was a leap. Now, first, there's a familiarity, right? They're already using animals as their subjects, and they know how dangerous this is. And if they, you know, were to do human to human transfusion experiments, it's very likely at least one of the patients would die. Well, it's better to have an animal donor die than a human donor. So animals seem to be a very logical way of getting around the question. But the quality of the blood for animals was considered to be more pure, strangely enough. You know, animal blood, it's more pure. They don't smoke, they don't swear. So reach for something that's cleaner, that's pure, that's more predictable. And then in the first transfusion trials, they're using sheep. Well, nothing could be more pure than sheep blood, you know, blood of Christ, Lamb of God.
Right.
It makes complete and total sense, again, framing it through the worldview, that they would first reach for animals as donors rather than humans.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm on the line with Holly Tucker, author of the new book, Bloodwork, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution. We have something interesting planned this week. Robin Swoopy McCarthy of the Skepticality podcast is deeply interested in the topic, and she was thrilled with Holly's book. So throughout the episode, she'll be submitting questions that we'll record later and we'll edit them in. And if any episode was perfect for an experiment, it's this one. So at the heart of this book, and you're touching on it, is Jean-Baptiste Denis.
He's the center of this book in many ways because he was the first to transfuse humans in 1667. He was a French doctor who, you know, in working on this book and spending so much time living with Jean-Baptiste Denis, I still am not quite sure how I feel about him. At first, I admire him immensely because he was a man of very low birth. His father was an artisan. And he really was never meant to be on the medical landscape in a prominent way, because to be a physician in the 17th century, as to a certain degree it is still now, you needed to have a good amount of resources, and you needed to come from a family background that really prized education, and you had to be of noble birth. Jean-Baptiste was not of noble birth. Odds were doubly against him because he ended up training in the south of France in Montpellier. Now, the University of Paris and its medical program was considered the top of the top. And it was from this program that the royal doctors would be drawn, and a very small and elite group of doctors would be allowed to practice in the Paris capital. So Denis trains in Montpellier. So Montpellier was, according to legend, is where the losers went. It was a party school. The medical students, according to rumors in Paris, were the ones, they drank a lot, they hung out a lot with prostitutes, and they spent all of their time during the day not really studying medicine, but getting into these questions like, what is life? So Denis has all these odds against him, but he's not satisfied with the lot that life has given him. And he hopes very much to make a name for himself in Paris despite the odds. So I admire him for that. On the other hand, he also has an ego that spans here to Mars. He wants to do everything he can to make sure that not only is he able to live a productive life as a physician, he wants to make a huge name for himself. So he was newly minted for medical school when all of this started. And he was basically a grunt teaching anatomy lessons to medical students at the University of Paris. You know, being a surgeon, you might as well be, you know, like the school janitor.
Which is fascinating, because in present-day society, we give surgeons a lot more credit, really.
Yeah, you know, it's only, oh, I don't want to make a mistake here, but mid-18th century that surgeons start to be recognized as a guild, and they're still part of the lower classes of medicine. And surgery only starts to slowly move its way into status, I would say early 19th century. The high status of surgery is really a recent phenomenon, because physicians were really not associated with patient care per se. They were associated with intense knowledge and mastery of deep philosophical questions and mastery of the ancients and of ancient wisdom of the body. So it's very likely that a physician wouldn't even see a patient in the 17th century. So the physicians were the book smart guys, and the surgeons were the grunts. And Denis did not want to be stuck as a surgeon. He had been trained as a physician. So he knows that he's got to make a name for himself. And the way he does it is blood transfusion. And there's a reason for it. It was to make a name for himself, and also to enrage, to get the attention of the medical elite by doing something that was considered extraordinarily distasteful.
What I'd like to get into is this sort of metaphysical area around the idea of blood transfusions. Mm-hmm. This brought up a lot of those questions for people practicing medicine about souls and where they reside.
And that's a core question in all of this. The very idea of using animal blood in animal to human transfusions is based entirely on debates and discussions surrounding the soul in the 17th century. And the key figure for that is René Descartes. He's the guy who, of course, we all know, I think, therefore I am. And he left a lasting legacy on medicine because he's often considered to be the founder of the scientific method, right? Where take nothing for true.
Right.
Don't accept the wisdom of the ancients until you've proven it. And you can see where Harvey's coming from as well. And to take a problem, divide it into small, teeny, tiny, tiny little bits, take the smallest bits first, work your way up, and along the way, make sure you are replicating your data and verifying your conclusions so that by the time you've studied all of the questions in depth, you can come to at least some semblance of confidence regarding truth. So Descartes has this lasting legacy, and we have a tendency to idolize him in a way, but he was also exiled from France for his other beliefs in the way the human body worked. He believed, much to the contrary of the ancients and to tradition, that there was really little that separated animals and humans. Each, of course, had bodies, and that those bodies functioned like machines. Now, this is the age where they've discovered hydraulics. They're exploring barometers, right? So this is becoming a highly mechanistic worldview. Descartes says that, you know, animal bodies function just like ours. We're all machines. Mm-hmm. But the difference between animals and humans is that humans have souls. Humans have the ability to reason, and they can speak. And Descartes says, well, if we both have bodies, animals and humans, how is it that we have this capacity and animals don't? So he posits that, well, that capacity of speech and reason and the presence of a soul is something that is outside of the body. It's non-corporeal. And that then allows both the vivisectionists, right, the possibility, well, if animals don't have souls, they can't suffer pain. They can't articulate pain. And their machines is we can take them apart in the ways that we'd want to be able to take a human body apart had there not been any moral or ethical problems with that. And so the same thing with blood transfusion, right, is that if the soul exists outside of the body, that means it doesn't exist in the blood. So that means that the blood functions something like oil in a car. So that we can transfuse, you know, the oil of one into the oil of another without problems. But the biggest social, and also I would say, not just, you know, among the lay public, but also among learned physicians, what if Descartes is wrong? What if the soul is based in blood? What are we doing?
Now, we've spoken of the religious and the academic problems with the idea of blood transfusions. But there was also sort of an adverse political relationship at this time.
Oh my goodness, yes. You know, this is just not the story of really weird and wacky experiments that they were doing with bodies and this voyeuristic odd thing that they were doing with animals and humans. Blood actually gets at the heart of early modern politics and specifically about this race for scientific dominance. There was not just a real war going on between England and France. It's all part of this larger battle to own knowledge that's happening in the scientific revolution.
And I'm going to ask you a question from the chat room that has absolutely nothing to do with any of that. This is from Josh in the chat.
Bram Stoker's Dracula featured blood transfusions. Today this would be a reasonable treatment for vampirism, but was radical when the book was published in 1897. What context are we modern readers missing?
It's really interesting when you look in the 19th century with texts like Dracula, Frankenstein, etc., that they would start to imagine science gone wrong, right? And bloodlust and various things like that, because the 19th century constituted in its own way a scientific revolution. You have the discovery of germ theory, discovery of anesthesia, antisepsis. A lot of things are happening in the 19th century, and we start to see that anchored in the literature. Now, to get at what I think Josh was trying to ask is, what's happening with blood in the 19th century? Blood transfusions are starting to pick back up. After this whole thing with Jean-Baptiste Denis, the English and the French, blood transfusion was actually banned. And no one pursued blood transfusion again for nearly 150 years until 1813. Now, we're talking about dates that, you know, are 60, 70, 80 years from Bram Stoker. But those transfusion experiments started back up in England in an obstetrical hospital by a physician named Blundell, who was an obstetrician who was seeing lots of women hemorrhaging to death. And he began to wonder whether it would be possible to, well, reanimate them. So he first did what Denis did. He did interspecies experiments. But in this case, what he did is he took human blood and infused it into dogs. And the dogs all died. So he said, well, okay, maybe interspecies trials are not the thing to do. And so he started transfusing new mothers with the blood of their husbands or with staff members he had on call. And after that, there were all different types of sorts of experiments going all the way up to the late 19th century to try to figure out, A, if blood transfusion could work, B, how they could handle problems of clotting and trying ways to defibrinate blood. So it is interesting that in the 19th century, we would have a text like Bram Stoker and that there would be a blood transfusion in there. It makes complete sense to me.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Holly Tucker, who is apparently a master at spinning a question into one she wants to answer. Well done. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's a panel discussion on the pluses and pitfalls of using humor to promote science. We're joined by science comedian Brian Mallow, blogger SciCurious, and Brian Thompson, host of the Amateur Scientist podcast. They'll look at how engaging the funny bone can help the brain absorb the science that powers our world. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is Holly Tucker, the author of the new book, Blood Work.
We have a question via Twitter from Chris Lindsay. He'd like you to tell the story about when George Washington died in 1799.
This is something that, you know, it's out of my area of specialty, but one of the odd things that I learned is that George Washington became suddenly ill with a fever and then also had swelling in his throat. So, of course, they reached immediately and began to bloodlet him. And they did a whole series of bloodletting. And then he died. And historians of medicine and also historians generally have always wondered, did George Washington die of what was eventually determined to be an infection of the epiglottis, or was it because he had just been bloodlet to death? And many historians feel that it was probably the fact that he had an extraordinary amount of blood removed from his body before his death. But one part that was really interesting that we don't hear much about is that not long after his death, George Washington's body was laid out in state. And some family members were there, and one of the family members brought an architect, actually, who was also a physician, the architect who was responsible for the design of the U.S. Capitol building. And he made an interesting proposal. He said, well, you know, there might be a way to revive George Washington if we transfuse him with lamb's blood. Now, what was interesting to me is that the response of the family was, no, thank you. But it wasn't because they found the proposition so unusually weird. It was rather, you know what, he lived a very fine and noble life. Let's leave him in peace. That's a story that we really don't know much. Really, it's not part of the legend of George Washington, but it just goes to show that the whole idea of interspecies transfusions had continued to lurk in the backs of physicians' minds. It's part of the long-standing imaginations about blood that continued for several hundred years after Denis.
Well, let's talk about the first successful, to a certain extent, incidents of blood transfusion from animals to humans.
There were at least four or five different cases in the 17th century of humans being transfused with animals. The first was by Jean-Baptiste Denis, of a young boy who had been suffering from fevers for over a month. And Denis, I suspect, although I have no documents to prove this, Denis paid the mother to transfuse her son with sheep's blood, and the boy survived. We don't know much about the fever. Denis doesn't talk about whether the fever was cured or abated. It seems in his documents, in his case reports, that we do have is that Denis considered the transfusion to be a success because the boy survived. No surprise, right? I mean, we'd all be delighted if this patient survived after an animal transfusion. Now, I'm sure many of the readers are thinking, well, how in the world could somebody survive an animal blood transfusion? And if you think about the types of tools that they were using to do these blood transfusions, it's very likely that not a lot, if any, blood actually made it into the patient. They were using goose quills as their tubes. And as blood's moving from the animal to the human, you know, it's also dripping so much of it on the outside. And there are descriptions where clotting takes place nearly immediately within the quills. Now, the patients do show reactions of transfusion incompatibility, right? There's fever at the transfusion site, dizziness, nausea, bowel difficulties, but those seem to be short-lived. So the second transfusion, the first one was with lamb's blood, the lamb was provided by a butcher. The second transfusion was of a butcher. And again, I can't be sure of this, but I suspect that the butcher who was transfused is actually the butcher who provided the lamb for the first experiment, because the butcher in the first experiment is this really gregarious guy, and the butcher who was transfused in the second experiment is also gregarious. He was definitely paid for his services and was delighted to be a guinea pig. He was very happy to have the money, and Denis was walking along and ended up looking in the window of the local tavern not long after the experiment and was absolutely outraged to see his patient drinking mightily in the bar. And he went in to confront the patient because he was just so angry that the guy would go drink. But of course, I mean, he got tons of money. He wants to use it wisely, right? And it's only as he starts talking to the butcher, and the butcher is surrounded by a whole bunch of others, his drunk buddies, and they're saying, "Transfuse me! Yeah! Hey, pay me some money! Transfuse me! I want one of those transfusions!" That Denis actually leaves the bar feeling very pleased, actually, that first, the butcher is still alive, and second, that there's a whole crowd of people who just think it's the greatest thing on the planet. So those were the first two transfusions. The third is the one, however, that was the most controversial and that ended up producing a court case and a murder trial. And the murder trial is the centerpiece of the story that I'm telling in Blood Work. So Denis has at this point outraged the English because the English were so close to performing the same types of experiments, animal-human experiments, but they moved a little bit slower. And that's likely because the idea of using humans in experiments is not something that has become commonplace. You know, even though, you know, the difference between medicine and experimentation in this period, well, there is no real difference, right? They're drilling skulls, they're doing cesarean sections without anesthesia, without antisepsis. So any type of medical procedure is an experiment in a way. To first start with the experiment and to do a medical procedure as an experiment is something that's not quite in the mindset of the time. And so Denis actually scooped the English in his decision to do that and outraged them for two reasons. One, because he scooped them, and second, because in his PR campaign following these first two successful transfusions, never once did he credit Harvey, never once did he credit Wren and other people in the Royal Society who had been doing animal-to-animal transfusions, which was unheard of. Usually you go, "Thank you, I had this idea, thanks too." And to claim it as a French experiment when England and France are in the depths of war, it made them very angry. So Denis had made no friends as he's moving into the third experiment. But he is hungry for greater notoriety. So he decides he's going to now pick a third patient. And he picks one of the most famous men in Paris to do it on. Antoine Mauroy was a villager of very low social standing who had lived in Paris for quite a while and had served as a valet for a woman named Madame de Sévigné, who was basically the broker of the literary elite of Paris. And he had fallen in love with a noblewoman and believed that he was actually going to be able to marry her. Well, of course, a noblewoman is never going to marry a peasant, even if he's a valet. And from that point forward, he falls into the depths of mental illness and is kicked out of Madame de Sévigné's home after he tries to set fire to it, and then runs around the streets of one of the nicest districts, one of the nicest quarters of Paris, naked and basically tormenting anybody around. So he's at once legendary because of his former status. He's also the laughingstock of the Paris elite. And Denis says, "Well, you know what? I'm going to take Antoine Mauroy and I'm going to transfuse him and I'm going to cure him of his mental illness." Two transfusions later, Mauroy dies. And the bulk of the debates surrounding blood transfusion are centered precisely on that death. Denis is called up on murder charges in what is, I think, one of the very first medical malpractice cases in early Europe, and basically has to argue his innocence at court.
Now, I do want to talk more about that, but if I don't get you to answer some of these listener questions, I will need a transfusion. So this question is from Swoopy.
How long did it take before safe anticoagulants were discovered and implemented?
It took centuries. the first anticoagulants were discovered in 1914 on the battlefields of World War I, sodium citrate. And that constitutes a turning point in the history of transfusion, because up until that point, from Blundell in 1813 up to 1914, is you had to have both donor and recipient in the same place and literally connected. So that changed everything, because transfusions could then be administered remotely.
Now we have a question from Kylie Sturgis.
Do you think that the bans on blood donation by homosexuals will ever be lifted?
I think it's a crucial question, because it shows us in many ways how blood is used to identify groups, for better and for worse. And that another example of blood being not accepted for transfusions is the case of African-American blood.
Right.
African-American blood was at first rejected for transfusions and then later segregated. For example, the Red Cross, and I'll, as a disclaimer, is I'm a dedicated diehard supporter of the Red Cross. It is very interesting to me is that the Red Cross was segregating blood in the 1940s, admittedly not as something as being entirely scientific, but rather recognizing that there were all different types of social controversies surrounding the mixing of blood. And so it was felt at the time that it was a more expedient way to allow people to accept blood transfusions. Now, interestingly, in the 1940s as well, and especially, 1957 is a fascinating moment, because a physician came out in 1957 claiming that, you know, we need to codify this. We need to make a statement that African-American blood is entirely antithetical to white blood. And he claimed to have a white patient who received a blood transfusion from another white patient and died. And the physician's name was Scudder. And Scudder claimed that the reason why the patient died after a white-to-white transfusion was because he'd been previously transfused with African-American blood and therefore had developed a resistance to white blood, right, through antibodies. And Scudder made this claim that, you know, this shows us that we need to stick to the motto of, and I'm quoting Scudder, unto each his own when it comes to blood. Now, interestingly, this is right at the thick of deep, deep racial divisions in the United States. But the medical community lashes out against Scudder. The American Association of Blood Banks, the following year, ends up making a unilateral statement saying that this is absolutely an unacceptable policy. And a number of physicians at Columbia University end up writing an opinion piece in the New York Times saying, this whole racialized concept of blood is not scientifically grounded. And still, racial segregation of blood continues, especially in southern states, until the early 70s. So I think to answer that question in a roundabout way is I think that blood, because it gets to who we are or who we like to think ourselves to be or who we would like to not think ourselves to be.
Exactly.
Blood is all about identity and all about a balance between social understandings of identity and scientific understandings of what it is. And that's a really delicate balance to make.
Well, I realize you didn't quite finish talking about what exactly happened to Denis and the future of blood transfusions. But I think actually we're not going to talk about that, because it will encourage people to buy this book, because it is brilliant. You guys, I'm not even joking. This is a brilliant book. Anybody who listens to this show knows that I love the history of science. I think it's a really good way to get people interested in current science, really. And yours is exactly the example that I want to show people when I want to give them something entertaining, because this is actually a mystery novel as well. I feel like if I allow you to finish it, you're going to give it away.
Nan, I will not finish it. And it is a very wacky, fun, and deeply researched story, that's for sure.
Well, we have a question from Swoopy.
What are the challenges of writing a science book where, in order for the story to make sense and be compelling, you have to add in as much narrative as you can?
You got to the heart of the problem. I spent more time on the floor of my home office with pages and pages spread out with a pair of scissors, cutting and taping and plotting narrative trajectory than I ever understood had to happen in a well-written book. The challenges are finding just the right balance of giving the backstory and the history that readers need to make sense of the story, and doing it in a way that is not pedantic, that doesn't come off as overly professorial, and also in a way that doesn't dumb things down. And so finding the right balance is really tricky. And trying to get those learning moments in there in such a way that they didn't disturb the overarching narrative, and also that they weren't too long, nor were they too short, that's an art. And that it was a learning experience for me as I was crafting this book.
Speaking of the book, in your prologue, you ask the reader to keep two questions in mind. And so I'm going to have to, of course, put them to you. Should a society set limits on its science? If so, how and at what price?
Oh, you're tricky. I'll actually bypass that for now, because I don't want to give precisely my answers, because I've tried so hard to make this a neutral book in which there's space for all answers, right? In which people can understand that the types of debates that are going on around biomedical innovations right now, whether it's a human embryological stem cell research, interspecies research, is that the types of pushbacks and the types of debates, both ideological and other, are natural and normal. It's part of what has to happen when a society is trying to decide whether or not to put limits on their science. Now, here's where history comes in on that second question. If so, at what price? And to that, you know, you can spin another question. Is I've spent a lot of time looking at how the 17th century tried to respond to blood transfusion as a medical innovation. That if you talk to any physician and anybody in the medical professions now, we can't imagine doing modern medicine without, right? But in the 17th century, it was so hotly contested, vehemently contested, that it scared so many people that Denis was eventually not found guilty of murder, but the courts determined that others had had a hand in the murder and that his patient had actually been poisoned because transfusion was so scary. The question I have is, if so, at what price, how is history going to look back at our moment and how we're trying to dig through these equally thorny questions? And in private, I'll tell you exactly what I would love to see happen or not happen. But it's just stunning and actually unsettling to me, is to listen to people draw their lines so deeply in the sand that discussions can't happen. So part of what I'm trying to do is to use this case of blood transfusion as a way to say, we all have a stake in these discussions. We may not always agree with each other, and that's always going to happen. But if we don't have an opportunity to talk calmly, constructively, and productively, we're really not going to get anywhere, just as what happened in the 17th century and this vital tool that we use daily, right, was banned. How many lives would have been saved, and also how many lives would have been lost had blood transfusion been allowed to continue?
And on that note, that's a perfect ending. Wonderful to have you here, Holly.
Thanks. This is a lot of fun.
There's a link to Holly Tucker's site on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR, 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.